A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's heavy. 31 wild sloths died at Sloth World in Orlando, a facility that marketed itself as a conservation paradise. The USDA investigation report dropped May 9th, and it confirms what the Sloth Conservation Foundation had been warning about since November of 2025. This wasn't some freak accident, it was the predictable outcome of a broken model. And it forces a question most families never think to ask when they walk through those turnstiles. Is there actually such a thing as an ethical zoo? How long have we been doing this? Can a zoo be held to any real standards? And if you're just a parent trying to figure out whether the place you're taking your kids is decent or deplorable, how do you even tell?
The Sloth World timeline is worth laying out because it shows how long a facility can operate with a clean marketing website while everything rots behind it. They opened June 2024 with a sloth encounter experience. $89 per person to hold, touch, and take photos with wild sloths. By November 2025, the Sloth Conservation Foundation published an open letter citing 14 deaths, unsanitary water sources, and animals showing clear stress behaviors. The facility stayed open. By April 2026, the death toll hit 31 before it was finally shut down. That's 17 more animals dead after the public warning. So the question isn't really about one bad actor in Orlando. It's about a system where a facility with 14 documented deaths, visible weight loss in its animals, and feces in the water supply can keep selling $89 tickets for another 5 months.
That's the thing. Zoos occupy this strange cultural space where we trust them as educational institutions, but they're fundamentally businesses that profit from animal captivity. Sloth World is the extreme case, the one that makes headlines and gets shut down, but it forces you to ask where the line actually is. If a zoo has slightly cleaner water and slightly healthier animals, but the same basic business model, is it ethical? Or is the whole framework compromised?
Here's what I want to do. We're going to trace the 4,000 plus year history of humans keeping wild animals in captivity, because the patterns are older than most people realize. Then we'll walk through the three main ethical frameworks animal rights advocates use to evaluate zoos. And we'll end with something practical, a checklist any family can use before their next zoo visit. Because 183 million Americans go to zoos every year, and most of them have no framework for evaluating what they're actually looking at.
The gap between what zoos claim to be and what they actually are, that's the episode. Whether that gap can ever be closed is the question I'm not sure anyone can answer yet.
Let's start at the beginning. The first zoos weren't about conservation at all. They were about power.
Of course they were.
The earliest known menagerie we have records for belonged to Shulgi of Ur, around 2100 BCE. This is a Sumerian king who collected exotic animals, lions, bears, wild cattle, and kept them in a dedicated park. The point wasn't education or science. It was demonstrating that his reach extended to the far corners of the known world. If you can bring a bear from the mountains to the middle of your city, you control the mountains.
Flexing on your enemies via wildlife collection. The original status symbol.
And it continues. Around 1490 BCE, the Egyptian pharaoh Hatshepsut sent an expedition to the land of Punt, probably modern-day Eritrea or Somalia, and brought back baboons, giraffes, and exotic birds. These were displayed in temple gardens. Again, the message is, I command resources and territory you can't even imagine. It's imperial pageantry using living creatures as props.
You can draw a straight line from Hatshepsut's giraffe to the tiger in a roadside zoo in Oklahoma. The impulse hasn't changed. What changed is how we justify it.
The shift toward the modern zoo begins in Europe. The Vienna Tiergarten opens in 1752. It's still operating, by the way. It's the oldest continuously operating zoo in the world. But the real inflection point is the London Zoo, which opened in 1828. And this is crucial. It was founded as a scientific institution. It was the zoological collection of the Zoological Society of London, and you couldn't just walk in. you needed a written invitation from a fellow.
A zoo with a guest list.
A zoo with a guest list. But within a decade, they were charging admission. The public demanded access, and the scientific mission quickly became secondary to the entertainment economics. By the 1840s, they were featuring animal performances, chimpanzees in human clothing drinking tea. The same institution that was founded for the study of natural history had become a spectacle within 15 years.
The rebranding problem isn't new. The tension between mission and money was there from the jump.
It gets darker. The 1878 Paris Exposition and the 1904 St. Cheen. Louis World's Fair featured what were explicitly called human zoos, indigenous people brought from Africa, Asia, and the Americas, and displayed in enclosures for European and American audiences to gawk at. This wasn't a separate phenomenon. It was the same institutions, the same logic, the same impulse to collect and display the exotic for entertainment applied to humans.
The logic of the zoo applied to people. That's not a tangent. That's the thesis. Once you've decided the containing living beings for display is morally neutral, the category of who counts as displayable becomes a matter of social convention, not principle.
The modern conservation narrative that zoos use to justify themselves really crystallizes in the 1980s. The Association of Zoos and Aquariums, the AZA, launched the Species Survival Plan program in 1981. The framing is powerful. Zoos are now arks, preserving genetic diversity against the coming flood of habitat loss and extinction. It's a compelling story. The question is whether the data supports it. A 2023 study in the journal Conservation Biology examined AZA member expenditures and found that on average, only 0.2% of their budgets go to field conservation. That's not 2%. That's 0.2%. Meanwhile, about 15% goes to new exhibits, which are, fundamentally, customer acquisition and retention tools.
0.2% on the thing they say is their reason for existing.
Even the Species Survival Plan itself has limited success. The AZA's own data shows that only about 15% of SSP species have self-sustaining captive populations. For the other 85%, the captive population isn't viable long-term without bringing in more wild animals, which is the thing we're supposedly trying to avoid.
The ark metaphor falls apart. You're not preserving species for reintroduction if the captive population can't sustain itself. You're just running a permanent extraction pipeline from the wild.
Captive breeding has genuinely worked for a small number of species. The California condor went from 27 individuals in 1987 to over 500 today, with more than half living in the wild. The black-footed ferret, the Arabian oryx, these are real success stories, but we're talking about maybe 20 species out of the thousands that zoos display.
Sloth World wasn't even pretending to be part of that.
Sloth World wasn't AZA accredited at all. It was a USDA licensed exhibitor, which is a much lower bar. The USDA license is essentially a business license. It says you're allowed to display animals commercially. The Animal Welfare Act standards are minimal, and enforcement is remarkably thin. The USDA has fewer than 100 inspectors for over 10,000 licensed facilities. The January 2026 inspection report for Sloth World noted accumulated feces in water sources, inadequate veterinary care, and multiple sloths with unkempt fur and apparent weight loss. And the facility remained open for 3 more months.
The regulator that's supposed to catch this had documented the problems, and the response was essentially a shrug. That's not a failure of enforcement. That's enforcement working as designed, which is to say, barely.
The structural incentive problem is brutal. A zoo's revenue comes from attendance. Attendance is driven by new exhibits, cute baby animals, and encounter experiences. Conservation spending doesn't fill the parking lot. So even well-intentioned zoo directors face a constant pressure to prioritize the entertainment side over the conservation side. The marketing says conservation, but the budget says entertainment.
Which brings us to the ethical question. If the history of zoos is a history of power and entertainment dressed up as science, is the whole enterprise irredeemable, or can a zoo actually be ethical?
There are 3 main frameworks for thinking about this, and they're in tension with each other. They don't reconcile neatly. The first is the welfarist position. Zoos can be ethical if they meet certain standards of care, enrichment, and conservation contribution. The second is the abolitionist position. Captivity itself is inherently harmful, regardless of conditions. The third is the pragmatic position. Some zoos are necessary for the conservation of critically endangered species, but most are unnecessary and should be phased out.
Let's take them one at a time. The welfarist framework. What are the actual standards?
The classic model is the Five Freedoms, developed in the 1960s for farm animals and later applied to zoo animals. Freedom from hunger and thirst. Freedom from discomfort. Freedom from pain, injury, and disease. Freedom to express normal behavior. And freedom from fear and distress. If you apply that framework to sloths specifically, you get very concrete requirements. Sloths need 15 to 20 hours of sleep per day. They need a diet of specific leaves. They're folivores with specialized digestive systems. They need ambient temperatures between 75 and 85 degrees Fahrenheit. And they need minimal handling. Sloths are solitary, easily stressed animals. Sloth World failed on all five freedoms.
Every single one.
Every single one. And that's the welfarist case against Sloth World. It's not that zoos are inherently wrong, it's that this specific facility failed to meet even basic welfare standards. The welfarist would say, close Sloth World, prosecute the owners, and strengthen enforcement, but don't condemn the entire model.
The abolitionist says, hold on.
The abolitionist says the problem isn't bad zoos, it's the concept of zoos. The philosopher Lori Grun at Wesleyan has developed what she calls an entangled empathy framework. The argument is that even well-intentioned captivity distorts the animal's experience of its own life. A sloth in an enclosure, even a good enclosure, is not living the life of a sloth. Its relationships, its movements, its choices, its sensory world, all of it is constrained in ways that matter to the animal, even if we can't see the distress from outside.
This is where the smile thing becomes relevant. People look at a sloth and see that permanent facial expression that looks like a smile, and they think the animal is happy. But it's just facial anatomy. The animal could be in chronic stress, and the face reads as contented to a human visitor.
The ethologist Jonathan Balcom published a book in 2023 called The Exultant Arc, and he documents measurable stress behaviors in zoo animals even in what are considered good facilities. Pacing. That repetitive back-and-forth walking you see in big cats. Stereotypes. Repetitive, apparently functionless behaviors like rocking or self-grooming to the point of injury. Reduced lifespan compared to wild counterparts, even with veterinary care. His argument is that these aren't bugs in otherwise good zoos, they're features of captivity itself.
The abolitionist position is that no amount of enrichment makes a cage, not a cage. The cage can be cleaner or dirtier, bigger or smaller, but it's still a cage.
Then there's the pragmatic position, which tries to split the difference. It acknowledges that for some critically endangered species, captive breeding is the only thing standing between them and extinction. The Amur leopard, the Sumatran rhino, the vaquita. If we lose the captive populations, we lose the species. The pragmatist says keep those facilities, fund them properly, and be honest that they're lifeboats, not entertainment. But phase out the display of species that aren't conservation dependent. You don't need a zoo to see meerkats. You can watch them on a nature documentary filmed in the Kalahari.
The counter-argument from zoos is always, but how will people care about animals they never see in person?
Which is an empirical claim, and the evidence for it is thin. A 2019 study in the journal Frontiers in Psychology found that zoo visitors showed no measurable increase in conservation knowledge or pro-conservation attitudes after their visit, compared to a control group. People leave the zoo knowing roughly what they knew when they arrived. They had a nice day. They didn't become conservationists.
The educational argument, which is the main moral justification zoos offer, doesn't actually hold up when you test it.
Even when zoos do genuine conservation work, the scale is often misrepresented. The San Diego Zoo Wildlife Alliance is one of the better actors. They publish detailed conservation spending, and it comes to about 8% of their budget. That's 40 times the AZA average, and it's still below what many advocates consider adequate. The Detroit Zoo made headlines in 2024 when they moved their lone polar bear to a sanctuary, acknowledging that even a good zoo exhibit couldn't meet the spatial and behavioral needs of a polar bear. That's an honest institution making a hard call. But it's also an admission that the zoo model failed for that animal.
Let's talk about the certification landscape, because this is where the average family gets completely lost. You're planning a weekend outing with the kids. You type zoo near me into Google. You get a list. How do you know which ones are legitimate?
The landscape is confusing by design. The gold standard in the U.S. is AZA accreditation, but it only covers about 240 facilities, roughly 10% of the zoos and aquariums in the country. AZA accreditation requires meeting standards for animal care, veterinary programs, conservation, education, and safety. It's not perfect, but it's the best filter we have. If a facility is AZA accredited, it has passed a multi-year review process with unannounced inspections.
Sloth World wasn't AZA. Most roadside zoos aren't.
Most aren't. And the fallback that many facilities point to is their USDA license, which sounds official and reassuring. But as we've covered, it's a business license with minimal welfare standards and weak enforcement. Having a USDA license tells you almost nothing about animal welfare.
USDA license is table stakes. It's the equivalent of a restaurant having a business license but no health inspection grade.
Then there's the Global Federation of Animal Sanctuaries, GFAS, which certifies true sanctuaries. These are facilities that don't breed animals, don't buy or sell them, and don't use them for commercial entertainment. If an animal is there, it's because it can't survive in the wild. GFAS certification is a strong signal, but most families aren't visiting sanctuaries. They're visiting zoos.
There's no single consumer-facing badge, no equivalent of the LEED certification for green buildings or the Fair Trade label for coffee. Nothing you can glance at and know.
That's the core problem. The system is self-policing and opaque. The Sloth Conservation Foundation has been very clear about what to look for. AZA accreditation is the starting point, not the finish line. You also want to see a dedicated conservation program with published financials. If they're not transparent about how much they spend on conservation, assume it's close to zero. And you want to avoid any facility that offers encounter or interaction experiences with wild animals.
The encounter economy. That's the reddest of red flags.
It's almost always welfare compromising. Wild animals don't benefit from being handled by strangers. They tolerate it, or they shut down, or they get sick. The encounter experience teaches visitors one thing, that wild animals exist for human entertainment. That's the lesson. Not conservation, not respect, not ecological understanding. Just pay money, touch animal, take photo.
Sloth World was built entirely on that model. $89 to hold a sloth. The whole business was the encounter.
Here's a practical thing most people don't know. USDA inspection reports are public records. You can search for any licensed facility and read the reports. They're not always easy to find. The USDA's public search tool is clunky, but they're there. If a facility has repeated citations for inadequate veterinary care, unsanitary conditions, or animals showing signs of stress, that's information you want before you buy tickets.
We're building toward a checklist. Let's put it together. You're a family planning a zoo visit. What do you actually do?
Step 1. Check AZA accreditation at az.org. If the facility isn't listed, that doesn't automatically mean it's bad, but it means you need to dig deeper. Step 2. Search the facility name plus USDA inspection report. Read what the inspectors found. Step 3. Look for published conservation spending on the facility's website. If it's not there, ask them. If they can't or won't tell you, that's an answer. Step 4. Avoid any facility that offers encounter or interaction experiences with wild animals. Petting zoos with domesticated animals are different, but if they're letting you hold a sloth, a tiger cub, or a primate, walk away. Step 5. Prefer facilities that participate in the species survival plan and can tell you which species they're actively working to conserve.
That's 5 steps. It's not complicated, but it does require doing the homework before you go, which most people won't do, because the zoo visit is supposed to be spontaneous and fun, not a research project.
That's the structural advantage bad zoos have. They count on you not checking. They count on the fact that a family driving past a billboard for Sloth World with a smiling sloth on it isn't going to pull over, search USDA inspection reports, and cross-reference AZA accreditation before deciding whether to stop. The business model depends on impulse and trust.
The trust is unearned. That's the thing. We've been conditioned to assume that a place with animals and a ticket booth is basically fine, that someone somewhere is checking. And the Sloth World case shows that the someone somewhere had checked, had documented the problems, and nothing happened for months while animals kept dying.
The deeper question underneath all of this, and I think this is what the prompt is really getting at, is whether. Is there such a thing as an ethical zoo is even the right question. Maybe a better question is, what is this zoo actually doing for conservation? If the honest answer is entertaining visitors, it's not an ethical zoo. If the answer includes measurable, transparent, independently verified conservation work, it might be. But the burden of proof should be on the zoo, not on the visitor.
Right now, the burden is completely inverted. The zoo puts up a website with the word conservation on it 17 times, and you're supposed to take it on faith. Meanwhile, the actual conservation spending is 0.2%.
There are things listeners can do beyond the checklist. Support true sanctuaries, GFAS certified facilities, rather than zoos when you have the choice. Donate directly to field conservation organizations like the Sloth Conservation Foundation, which was sounding the alarm about Sloth World when nobody was listening. And when you do visit a zoo, pay attention to the animals themselves. Are they exhibiting natural behaviors? Are they hiding? Are they pacing? Your observations matter. If the animals look stressed, they probably are.
Post about it. The reason Sloth World eventually got shut down wasn't the USDA inspection report that had been sitting there for months. It was public pressure. It was the Sloth Conservation Foundation publishing their open letter. It was people paying attention and making noise.
Where does this leave us? The Sloth World tragedy is a symptom of a broken system, but it doesn't have to be the future. The question now is whether the USDA will reform its inspection and enforcement processes, whether the AZA will tighten its standards, or whether we'll see more Sloth Worlds, more facilities that market conservation while cutting every corner on welfare until the death toll forces a closure.
The stakes are only going up. As climate change shifts habitats and fragments ecosystems, more species are going to become dependent on captive breeding programs for survival. The ethical frameworks we build now, the standards we enforce, the transparency we demand, are going to matter more, not less. We need better answers than we've got.
If you found this episode useful, if the checklist is something you'll actually use, or if it changed how you think about your next zoo visit, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It helps other people find the show, and it helps us keep doing this.
If you want to support the organizations doing the actual work here, the Sloth Conservation Foundation is a good place to start. They were right about Sloth World when the regulators were wrong. That kind of independent advocacy matters.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the late 1600s, Basque whalers operating around the Kuril Islands recorded encountering a local language that used an ergative absolutive case system, a grammatical structure where the subject of an intransitive verb is treated like the object of a transitive verb. The language was never documented again. Linguists now believe it represents a lost branch of ergative languages that existed in the North Pacific, completely unrelated to the ergative systems that survive today in Basque itself.
A ghost grammar in the whaling logs.
I have so many questions and no way to answer any of them. This has been My Weird Props. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop. Find us at mywordprompts.com.
See you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Props, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.